Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk about If There Is I Haven't Found It Yet, which is a play playing at the Laura Pels Theater, Roundabout Theater Company. We're also going to talk about a lot of recordings that have come up in the last couple of months. We have the Desert Song, Call Me Madam, Pipe Dream, Get Gentlemen Before Blondes, Carrie. Plus, we talk about the Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS Flea Market and various other things that are happening in and around Broadway. Please join us.
Doing when I'm doing it for love. The kick that I get is my reward. If a boy is not a spender, I'm inclined to be more tender. And believe you me, I'm never bored. I get more thrills spending my evening in a quiet spot for two than up in a penthouse high above. If I had a palm that itches, I could go from rags to riches. But I love what I'm doing when I'm doing it for love.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, September 24th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FileSpotPhoto.com. He also writes for outlets such as NPR.org and Arts America. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer who you could read at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, at Critchaland on Fridays, and on the MTI blog all throughout the month. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. So, we have a show called If There Is I Haven't Found It Yet that is playing over at the Laura Pels, and Michael and Peter saw it. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, I thought it was a really very interesting, very well-written play that comes to us from England by Nick Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, directed by Michael Longhurst, and it's basically a show that uses global warming as a metaphor for the family dynamic in this particular family that consists of Brian O'Byrne and Michelle Gomez, Annie Funk, and in his American stage debut, I guess, Jake Gyllenhaal, who I must say gives a very, very excellent performance. You never know, obviously, when someone like that comes to the stage without a lot of experience on it. He has been in at least one show or one or two shows in London, but here he is on. Not on Broadway, off Broadway, and it's. I think it was very wise of him to make his debut in a sort of a not a terribly high profile situation like this. He's very, very good in it. The thing that impressed me. Well, one of the things that impressed me most is, to my ears, his British accent was spot on, absolutely spot on. And it's not a I'm no expert. I would describe it as a middle class British accent. It's not upper and it's not really lower either. Yeah, it sounded very, very meticulous to me. I think he really worked on it a lot, and. But aside from that, the technical aspect, he really inhabited the role very well. The character's name is Terry, and just very interesting relationships with the other family members. This wonderful actress named Annie Funk, who played Anna, and Brian O'Byrne is, he really is, I think, one of our greatest actors. And I have not seen him for a while, it seems to me. I don't know if I missed a couple of things, but I was very thrilled to see him again. My only issue really was I had some difficulty with understanding, but I felt like it wasn't the accent so much as the volume. The Laura Pels is not the greatest space in the world, especially acoustically, and especially in a case like this where it seemed to me that there was no amplification whatsoever. If there was any, it was very subtle. I actually, to be honest, I didn't really look closely in the credits to see, but I don't think there was. So that was a minus for me. But other than that, I thought it was a very strong production for the roundabout. And as many of you may have heard or read, it's got a very, very effective coup de théâtre at the end. The play starts with rain falling, and then later on, let's just say that a lot more water shows up on stage in a very, very effective way. I've never quite seen anything like it, and I probably don't expect to again. So I would say to definitely try to get to the show if you can. It's a very limited run, and the tickets I have to say are quite expensive, undoubtedly largely because of Mr. Gyllenhaal's presence, but I think you will find it worth it. And oh, another thing that really impressed me was it was obvious to me that there were quite a number of Jake's fans seated around me, and people who came, I'm sure, solely because of him. But I'm happy to say that they were extremely attentive. You could hear a pin drop in the theater. There was no none of the kind of horrors you might imagine. No texting, no talking. At least I didn't see any of that. So that really did my heart good and made me feel very, very positive about the whole thing. So yes, thumbs up from me on If There Is, I Haven't Found It Yet.
Peter, what did you think?
Well, I guess if you could hear a pin drop, that would be a very good compliment if it's early in the play, because that's when the stage actually was not wet. It gets wet by the end of the play, and if the pin dropped in the middle of all the water that flooded the stage, you wouldn't hear it anyway. I liked it too. I thought it was quite good. O'Byrne plays a guy named George, who's an academic, and he's somebody who's really obsessed with global warming and carbon footprints and things of that nature. So he's really into it. I mean, he's writing a book, and this is what makes him obsessive, to the point of which when he finds his wife has bought tomatoes at the store, he's very upset because they have a garden. She indicates that the tomatoes aren't turning out well. I'm not going to give away the joke. It's a very good joke, which she actually says. But but nevertheless, you know, he's that type of guy. But, you know, this is one of the people who sees the forest and the trees but doesn't see his own family. And that's what it's really about. He has a daughter who needs some help. She's an overweight girl. And God, you know, I was so impressed that Miss Funk, you know, went down to bra and panties, because, you know, as somebody who hasn't been seen, I, who haven't been seen in a bathing suit since the Johnson administration, you know, I really have to give her credit for doing that. You know, that's not an easy thing to do when you're not, when you don't look like a contemporary model. So anyway, she has a lot of problems, you know, being heavy and problems at school. And, you know, she's getting suspended for something she did. I won't say what. And into their life comes Terry, who is the role played by Jake. And what's very interesting to me is when the play started, there was entrance applause. All right, you expect that for him. Yeah, but it wasn't him. It wasn't he. It was actually Mr. O'Byrne that they were applauding. Now, were they applauding him? Did they think this was Jake? They do look alike, which is good for the play, too, because they are, after all, brothers in the play. So I'm not sure. I know he has a TV series, so maybe they were applauding him. I don't know. Was there applause at your performance for him, Michael? Entrance, the first thing that happened, the first thing you see, lights come up. We heard applause on Saturday afternoon.
No, actually, when I went, there wasn't for either of them. And
oh, how interesting.
Yeah. But I felt like, I mean, it was a positive thing. It was like people didn't want to break the mood. When Jay came on, you know.
Yeah, I never criticize people who don't give entrance applause. Believe me, I know exactly where you're coming from on that. And however, for the record, on Saturday afternoon, both of them got it. You know, but I did have to wonder if they thought that was Jake up there. I mean, yes, certainly Mr. O'Byrne is older. And looks it, but nevertheless, you know, you're sitting far back. You know, and the applause did come from the back. In fact. But there is a resemblance. Anyway, so here's his brother who shows up and just wreaks havoc. He doesn't mean to. He really thinks he's doing good things. He wants to help the girl. You know, he's giving her advice, and it's lousy advice, but he really believes he has all the answers. He doesn't have very many answers at all, if he has any at all. So so that's really the problem that's going on there. So I think the reason that we see people actually pick up furniture and throw it into what is essentially an orchestra pit, which is filled with water. It's glassed in high enough so nobody gets splashed, I don't think. Maybe a little. But nevertheless, I think that means the fact that we're in this disposable society where we don't value very much. Jake knocks over something substantially valuable at one point, and something he has no right to deal with, and yet he throws that into the mix as well. So that's so I think that's what Mr. Payne is trying to say there. And with the water flooding the stage towards the end of the show, I guess the metaphor is the fact that, you know, as I say, he's worried more about global warming than he is about his family. However, Mr. Payne is saying, I think, that we have to worry about global warming and the family. We can't just have one and not the other. We have to be aware of everything that's going on here. We have to be more attuned. So I think that's what's happening there. I liked it. I did. I was very much engrossed. I thought the time flew by, and I thoroughly agree that Jake is spectacular in the role. I mean, as Michael says, you never know how people are going to react when they're on stage, you know, but he's such a bundle of nervous energy. Do you notice, Michael? I mean, he never stops moving.
Yes.
You know, his leg is going up and down, up and down, up and down while he's sitting down, that type of thing. He sways when he's standing, you know, that type of thing. Very, very nervous guy, and it really shows the fact that he's not terribly convinced of his own self-worth, even though he's ready to dispense advice at a moment's notice. So yeah, this is worth seeing. I'm sorry that it's so expensive, and I'm sorry the title is so convoluted that it's hard to remember, but I do think it's a worthwhile endeavor.
By the way, did you I didn't notice, was that a line in the play? Or if not, do we know what the title means exactly?
Oh, I didn't hear it as a line. You know, yeah. I might have missed it. You know, sometimes when I'm taking notes, you know, I'm in my own little world. But I don't think it is.
Kind of listening for it, and I didn't hear it. So,
okay.
I guess we could, you know, speculate on what that the title means. If there is, I haven't found it yet. A solution, okay. An answer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. Yeah.
So.
That's now I'm not going to sleep tonight thinking about that.
Peter mentioned this is going to be the weirdest segue of all time. Peter mentioned the Johnson administration. I just now came from Anita Gillette's spectacular show at Birdland, and Anita Gillette is one of the great Broadway stars of musicals and plays, hits and flops. And she told, she sang songs from every show she's been in, basically every major
really?
Show. Carnival, a cabaret, in which both of which she replaced in. They're playing our song, in which she replaced, and Tony Roberts was there, who played opposite her. She did a little tribute to Marvin Hamlisch, but then also, yes, the flops, Kelly and Jimmy. Julie Wilson was there, who was in Jimmy.
Nice. Yeah.
But anyway, she told a hilarious story about going to a reception at the White House during the Johnson administration, and she got drunk because she she didn't have anything to eat, and there was all this booze, and she sort of had a little kind of very close encounter with President Johnson. So she's doing it.
At least she did better than Eartha Kitt did when she was there at the White House.
Oh, God, yeah, I think she went over better than Eartha. But yeah. She's doing it again. She did this show, Anita did, in January of this year, and people loved it so much she brought it back tonight, and she's doing it again this coming Monday. So Peter and everyone else, if you find yourself free, you know, could definitely do a lot worse than going to Birdland and seeing Anita Gillette's really terrific show. And her voice is in really excellent shape. I think the only other time I've ever heard her sing live was at one of Scott Siegel's shows at Town Hall. But she's been doing a lot of straight theater and television lately. Really a multi-talented person.
Yeah, she was so good last year in The Big Neil.
Yes.
Really a terrific role for her, and she did very well by it. And people tend to forget, but she was the original leading lady in Chapter 2, opposite Judd Hirsch, playing essentially Marcia Mation, if you will, to his Neil Simon. So, yeah, and a sweetheart of a lady. I remember so vividly one night when she was on Johnny Carson in the 60s. She was doing Guys and Dolls at City Center. And I'm sure this was a setup question. But anyway, you know, he said to her, why would you want to do a show for 2 weeks? And she said, considering the shows I've done, 2 weeks is a run. you know, because Kelly only lasted one notorious night at the Broadhurst back in 1965. So,
yes, in fact, I think that Chapter 2 was the only show she originated that was a hit.
Is that right? You know, the one that was supposed to be a hit, of course, was Mr. President.
Right.
You know, and in a way, I had a feeling that the segue of the Johnson administration was going to involve Mr. President for obvious reasons. But, yeah, that was supposed to be a big hit, but it was a terrible disappointment. Yeah, it ran 8 months or so. But, I mean, nevertheless, anybody could walk up to the box office on a Saturday night and perhaps even for a high school reunion, everybody would be seated, you know. So it was a big disappointment. But she really sounds good on the album. I didn't see her do it, but she really does sound good in the album, and All American. And you know, did she talk about being thrown out of the gay life, by the way? Did she mention that at all?
She did. She told so many wonderful stories. You felt like you could have, you know, you could sit there for a week and she'd still have. And she talked about her friendship with Irving Berlin that came out of Mr. President, even though it was a flop. The gay life, that was another really interesting story. And
yeah, because they wrote her out. And then, as I recall, she came to New York and got All American right away. I mean, so she was out of work like 22 minutes, you know, something like that. It wasn't that they fired her. They wrote out her character in the gay life. It was that type of thing.
Yes.
They said, Anita, you stink. I mean, it wasn't that at all. It was the character was gone. So, the story I've always heard is, and she may have told this, about that in show business, the publication, which was bigger than Backstage at the time, I don't even know if Backstage was around in 62, when they were casting for Mr. President, it actually said, an Anita Gillette type.
She told that story.
Yeah, because indeed, Irving Berlin had seen All American and says, you know, gee, she'd be great, you know, And how many times did she have to audition to get the role?
I don't know that, but she did. That was the kicker, she said. So her agents called them up and said, well, what about Anita Gillette? And they said, oh, yeah, you know, bring her into audition.
I had heard once it was five times. She told me, I think it was three times, that she had to come back to get Anita Gillette had to come back three times to get the Anita Gillette role. You know, so everything about it is appealing, I tell you. Not really.
Well, you know, sometimes Broadway is a big success, and sometimes Broadway is a bust. So. The Broadway or Bust series on PBS wrapped up the other night. You guys wanted to say something about it?
I didn't say, Michael.
Yeah, well, you know, it really was absolutely fantastic. And you can watch, by now, I think you can watch all three episodes on the website. Just go to pbs.org and you should be able to find it. Because it aired on three consecutive Sunday nights, the last night being last night. And this was the documentary about the so-called Jimmy Awards, in which every year the best, the creme de la creme of high school musical theater stars are brought to New York to strut their stuff on Broadway and to, you know, basically compete for the award. Two awards are given, one to a female and one to a male, and out of 60 I believe kids from all over the country, and so it was really fun for me, especially because I've seen every one of the Jimmy Awards for the past 4 or 5 years or however many years they've been doing it. And one of one of the two who won, the male, happened to be featured quite prominently in the documentary, even though they didn't know, obviously, from the beginning if he, you know, who was going to win. So that was interesting that turned out that way. But really, watch it. It's so fascinating to see them kids work with the master teachers or you know, the consultants who include people like Liz Calloway and Michael McElroy and Telly Leung and Michael Feinstein dropped in one night when they were down at NYU rehearsing, and he wound up playing a Gershwin song for one of the kids. I really thought it was one of the best documentaries of its kind that I've seen. And of course, nowadays, when you have a documentary like that, in addition to the footage that the actual crew films, you have all of this footage that the kids themselves did with their iPhones or whatever woven into it. And it gives it such an air of immediacy and spontaneity. I can't recommend it more highly, you know, highly enough. It was really, really fantastic.
Well, then I'm going to go to their website and see it if I can tear myself away from another website. And I'm going to mention that. I just stumbled into this. I don't know how it happened. But anyway, there's something called WPA, like Work Progress Administration. I don't know if that's what it means, though. WPAfilmlibrary.com. Once again, WPAfilmlibrary.com. And it has clips from way back when. So I thought, let me see if they have something on. And I couldn't think of anything. Finally, I said, Merman. So I typed in Merman, and there's a clip of Ernest Borgnine waiting for her at the airport before they're married. Oh, he's so in love. He can't wait for her to get there. Oh, please let the plane be on time. It's amazing, really. I think everybody should go there, type in Merman, and watch this clip. I mean, it's hilarious to see that, because, you know, have you set a date yet? You know, they're asked. And I know they haven't for either the marriage or the divorce, it turns out. You know, they haven't done either one. But I urge you to do it. I think you'll have a good time watching. It's about 4 minutes long. And then go to Broadway and Bust.
Well, you know, I was one of the distinguished audience members tonight in Nene Gillette's show was Sheldon Harnick, as I may have mentioned, and I was talking to him about the fact that so much is on YouTube that you can't even imagine would ever be there. If you think there's something you want to see, don't assume it's not there. Go to YouTube and type in whatever it is, and you would be amazed at what's there. For example, there's a TV version of Pippin that was filmed in Toronto, I believe, years ago with Ben Vereen and Cheetah Rivera and William Catt in the title role. But the commercially released version that you can get on DVD or whatever, it was edited. Some complete songs were edited, and also verses of songs. But apparently, the whole thing was filmed, and then it was edited for, you know, broadcast or for commercial. And damned if the complete version is not available on YouTube in excellent video and sound. So I bookmarked that page, and I'm going to be watching that very soon.
Wow. That makes me want to go and see Top Banana and see if there's all the stuff that was cut out of Top Banana. Rosemary always talks about the fact that a lot of her stuff was cut out because she wouldn't fellate the producer. So, I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, but there is precious little of Rosemary in the picture, and it would be nice to see that stuff. So as soon as we're done, I'm going to Top Banana on YouTube and see if some Rosemary stuff is there. You never know.
Wow. It's amazing what we can find there on YouTube. You can find anything on YouTube, but still there might be that one or two things that you can't find, and you know where you can find them?
Where?
at the Broadway Cares Flea Market.
Yeah, yesterday. The Theater World Awards took a table, and I was there for about 3 hours. Meeting and greeting and having a wonderful time seeing all sorts of friends and making new friends. And it really did very well. My buddy Ken Bloom and Ken Cantor, who's in Phantom of the Opera. And Ken Cantor is one of the most tireless Broadway Cares equity fight age worker that I know. I mean, he is always rounding up phantom people, say, let's do this, let's do that, you know, let's we're going to do an entry in the Easter Bonnet, here's what we're going to do this year, that type of thing. I mean, he really is indefatigable when it comes to Broadway Cares Equity Fight Says, and there is a suite in heaven reserved for him because of that activity. But anyway, they sold cups from Broadway shows, you know, these plastic cups you get when you buy a drink, and they raised $10,000 between the cups and playbills that they sold, you know. So, I mean, that's really tremendous.
Wow.
I came down 44th Street yesterday. My heart sank a little because I came from 8th Avenue. And up to the Majestic was basically empty. And there used to be tables there at all. And I said, oh, it's really running out of steam. But no, what had happened, it had extended to those areas on Broadway that and 7th Avenue that are blocked off now for pedestrians, those little cute little molly-type areas with umbrellas where you can sit. So there was stuff going on there, too. So in essence, it was bigger. Perhaps bigger than ever. I'm not sure of that, but nevertheless, it certainly, if it wasn't, it was a contender to be one of the biggest ever. And it was really great to see so many people walking around, you know, lugging all the stuff they bought, thrilled to have it. And the deals were really, really good. I mean, they really were. I mean, if so many CDs were available for like $5 each, which I think is a steal, you know, scripts, all that kind of stuff. And a good time really was had by all.
Well, I'm looking at the press releases about the event. It was the 26th annual event, and they raised a spectacular $681,892, which is not bad for a flea market, you know?
And, you know, where else can you go? I mean, they had apparently lunch with Angela Lansbury, which I think went for $8,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
They had a incredible Barbara Streisand package, including tickets to her concert at the her upcoming concert at the Barclays Center, the brand new Barclays Center in Brooklyn. And, you know, I guess lots of extras. And that went for some ridiculous amount of money.
There better be lots of extras because I heard $40,000.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe plenty of extras.
They have walk-ons to Chicago, Lion King, Mamma Mia, Newsies, Rock of Ages, Phantom of the Opera. They all those together raised $39,600. Gwen Burden's opening night gift from the cast of Dancing fetched $3,600. All these things that are just you just can't buy them anywhere else. You can't. This is memorabilia that just doesn't happen anywhere else.
I would urge out of towners to really come to town for this next year, because for one thing, you're surrounded by people who love it the way you do, and that's something very special. You see people getting excited over the same things you get excited over, and it's just so nice to be able to walk down that street when no cars are there. I mean, it's yours. You know, it becomes to quote a movie song from Sweet Charity, my personal property. You know, it just does. And you really feel welcome, and you'll meet people that you've always wanted to meet. Celebrities are very, very forthcoming. Michael Mulhern was there working his table for his show. I mean, it was just nice to see so many people out there, civilians as well as people who really work in the trenches. I mean, it was just so nice. So, and thank God, it was a beautiful day too. It really was, you know. So that was quite special too. And we're very lucky that it worked out. Because Michael, I don't know, James, do you remember the year that rained and they had to have it in Roseland?
It moved into Roseland.
Oh, that was
years
horrible.
Ago,
yeah.
And it was, you know. I mean, part of the thrill is just being outdoors and having that wonderful fall weather, you know. So we hope that it continues, and whoever, be it Mother Nature or God, who gave us the good weather yesterday, we're very grateful.
Yeah, it was we were very fortunate to have some really beautiful fall weekends the last couple of weeks.
And if you don't have a lot of money, I will give a tip that is no big secret, but go towards the end of the day. They want to clear out the stuff even more then, and prices suddenly drop tremendously.
You're the second person who said that to me today. And
Is that right?
Yeah, so I guess it's not a secret.
It's not, but I mean, nevertheless, I imagine there are people who might not know that, and as a result, it's worth pointing out, you know, that if you're on a budget and times is hard, by all means, go towards the end. Of course, a lot of stuff will be gone. I don't need to tell you, but still, there's plenty that remains.
If you're on a budget, you don't have to just bring your your camera and hang around at the auction. I mean, you can get some great photographs at the auction of all sorts of people, all in one area. It's a high target market right there. It's you see lots of fun photos on Facebook in the last couple of days being posted by folks who were getting ready for the flea market and then finally taking it yesterday. So something else that we've talked about in the last couple of weeks we haven't had time to talk about is this flurry of CDs that have been released, and we're going to talk about a handful of them right now. Let's start with the reissue of Desert Song. Michael, let's start off there, okay?
Oh, Desert Song. This is a beautiful recording of a beautiful operetta with Giorgio Tozzi and a woman named Kathy Barr, who I'm not that familiar with, but apparently she had a brief, 15 minutes in the, I guess, in the late 50s and early 60s. And she does a really great job in the soprano role, even though she also did a lot of pop recordings, as a kind of a chanteuse. So that was her versatility there. And then we also have sounding amazing on this recording, Peter Palmer, whom many of us know from Lil Abner and maybe fewer of us know from Lorelei, singing tenor, flat out tenor and really sounding fantastic. And this was, this recording had newer orchestrations and it's conducted by Lemon Engel, who is considered the dean of Broadway conductors, and in pretty, spectacular living stereo early 60s sound. And this is on the archive label from Masterworks Broadway. You operetta fans out there, this is something that I didn't know if we'd ever see on CD, but here it is.
Well, as somebody who certainly writes a column for Masterworks Broadway, I'll tell you they really claim they're going to release everything in time. So I mean, this would certainly prove it. It is a very good recording, and even if you're not an operetta fan, I defy you to not like the riff song. It's one of the first songs in the show, if not the first one. And if you like Into the Fire from Scarlet Pimpernel, you will love the riff song. Into the Fire was the 90s version of the riff song. And I mean that as a compliment, by the way, Frank Wildhorn. Don't misunderstand me. I think it's my favorite song of his that he's ever written. And it does remind me of the riff song. So yes. I think it's a very good song, and it's worth hearing. I always remember seeing the 73 revival in Washington, D.C., and in came this aged man with a cane struggling to get to his seat. I was in the front row orchestra and he had the seat next to me. But I'm telling you, once that show started, he came alive and I really saw the young man that was in his face. The wrinkles went away. I saw who he was when he was a young man. So that's when I became a Desert Song fan. And yes, it's florid, heavy, syrupy music, no question. That's what operetta was. But I'll tell you, after listening to this album, I was amazed at how these songs stuck in my head for days. We all have this experience where something's going through your head and you say, wait a minute, what is that? Oh, yeah, that's one of the songs from the Desert Song. So give it a chance, those of you who are wary of operetta. You might be pleasantly surprised.
And there's it gave me hope for, I may have even mentioned, there's a recording of Rosemary with Giorgio Tozzi and Julie Andrews that has been out of print since God knows when. And that I think was probably part of the same series. So maybe they'll get to that one. I certainly
hope. In a way, it's surprising they haven't done that one yet, given that Julie Andrews is, after all, reasonably famous.
That's what I was thinking. I hope it's not a problem with the tapes being damaged or with the there might be some kind of a rights issue with that particular recording for some reason. But I hope not.
Frankly, I'm looking in my collection now to see if, by any chance, it's a case where. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was a little afraid that maybe it had already come out and I had forgotten about it. It has not come out. So we'll see. I'll lean on them to take a look at that and see what's going on. Because, yes, you're right. It would seem to be a natural.
So next up, we have Call Me Madam. excuse me. Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, this is a fascinating curiosity because how this ever was allowed to even happen is beyond me. And you know, Peter can speak to it too, but Call Me Madam was a show that Irving Berlin wrote for Ethel Merman as a follow-up to her spectacular success in Annie Get Your Gun. And the whole thing was conceived around her, and she apparently was amazing in it. And actually, there's a very good film version of it with Merman. Imagine that. She actually got to recreate the role on screen, and I love that movie. I think it's very well done. Incredibly, the cast album is on RCA Victor because they put up the money for it. But Merman was under contract to Decca Records, and so the original cast album of Call Me Madam has Dinah Shore in the Merman role, and on RCA. And then Merman went and made a recording of songs from the show with Dick Hames on Decca. But that one is, you know, it has different orchestrations, and it doesn't sound anything like a cast album. So, an incredibly odd, weird situation. Very few other situations like that I can think of. The cursed film version of Porgy and Bess. If you find the soundtrack album to that, it does not have Sammy Davis Jr. on it as Sport and Life because he was under contract to a company other than Columbia, and so it has Cab Calloway. There was one other I thought of, and I can't remember it.
Pal Joey. The 1952 Pal Joey, that had Jane Froman on it. She was a star at the time, you know, and it's hard to say what you really prefer. Do you really prefer hearing an original cast album that sounds like an original cast album, or do you want to have the star doing it with another group? I mean, it. Thank God that all this was resolved by the time, say, Streisand did Funny Girl, because, you know, I wouldn't want to hear some of the other Capitol artists, you know, do Funny Girl, because after all, Streisand was recording for Columbia and still does, for that matter.
And to add insult to injury, the Call Me Madam album on RCA, which, by the way, is billed as the original show album,
which is more honest than what the Decca one says, because the Decca one says, "Let me get it out here and get it right in front of me. Won't be long now. There it is with the yellow spine." A Decca Broadway original cast album. That's what the Merman one says.
That's a lie.
It is.
But anyway, the RCA one, aside from, you know, I mean, Dinah Shore is fine. She has a lovely voice, but she's really kind of miscast, and it's not a theatrical sound. It's a pop singer sound, and it's lovely, but she doesn't have the brass for the brassy parts and blah blah blah. But also on top of all that, somebody made the idiotic decision that there should be narration on this album.
Yeah, that was tough.
To explain the story. And that's another tremendous strike against it.
To be fair, this was RCA's first original cast album. In terms of, you know, really getting it together, that they were really going to do it. They did excerpts from, like, that's why Brigadoon and Allegro and High Button Shoes, those shows got selections, the entire thing, soup to nuts. And this was their first soup to nuts. And I guess somebody thought, well, maybe we better tell the story for those people who don't know what's going on. So I think it was done as an aid to the listener. And it didn't take long before people realized this was not a good idea. But I think this is an example of experimentation. Mm-hmm. In terms of Merman, of course, who was very famous for holding notes, loved doing that. That was her trademark. At the end of can you use any money today? The last line is, you can have mine, which is really surprising, you know, because mine is a consonant, ends with a consonant, and everybody knows that vowels are easier to sing. So so this is going to be a tough one, and Ethel, you know, is going to show off and show that she can hold the note a very, very long time. However, when you listen to the two recordings, you find out that the merm holds mine for 7 seconds. And Shaw makes it to 10. In fact, she's still singing after the orchestra stops. So I guess she felt she had something to prove there. So also, what's really amazing is Paul Lucas. Who would expect the guy who won an Oscar for Watch on the Rhine to be on an original cast album? But he was the leading man there, the one that the Merm romanced, or Dinah Shore romanced. So it's kind of interesting, an actor who was really known for dramatic roles to suddenly be crooning here in Call Me Madam. So yeah, it is a curiosity. It was an album that was desperately hard to get during the 60s and early 70s. It was reissued in the late 70s. But I remember everybody I knew scouring record stores, going under shelves, going into basements of record stores surreptitiously. Oh, sometime I'll tell you what happened to me in Baltimore once when I went to a downstairs into a record store surreptitiously. I'll show you the scar in my lower lip, what happened as a result of that. Anyway, you know, everybody was looking for Call Me Madam. We were desperate to find it. And then finally in 76, it was reissued. So it comes and goes and comes and goes, and it's good to have it back again.
But don't you think that when RCA put up the money for the whole thing, that they might have at that point gone to Decca and said, by the way, you know, we just want to confirm that you will, you know, let her out for X amount of money.
Yeah, frankly, I would like to know the full story, you know, like a timeline of what happened there. You know, did they just assume that because she was in the show, they would have no problem, that Decca would be adorable about it? Did they feel that, you know, well, we'll just offer them a couple of shekels and they'll take it? And then Decca said, you know, we want the sun and the moon. You know, I'd like to know what really happened. I've never heard a satisfactory story on that. And I guess as every second that ticks by, it's less likely that we will, because after all, a lot of the people involved in this are gone. So, I would like to know how this strange business decision wound up. And of course, you know, you can say RCA was stupid, but therefore wasn't Capitol more stupid when 2 years later when it did Pal Joey? I mean, after all, you know, they should have known that there was a problem there with the rights, and why not straighten that out in advance? Mm-hmm. It happened a little later too with O Captain. Abby Lane couldn't record on the album.
Oh, okay.
But that was a minor role. You know, that was a small thing, you know, so, but after that, I think pretty much, there may be a few we're forgetting, but pretty much original cast albums became original cast albums.
So next up we have, Pipe Dream, the live recording from City Center Encores. Michael, tell us about that.
Yeah, well, we have, two, you know, embarrassment of riches, two encores recordings that have just come out. Pipe Dream is on Ghost Light, is that right? Yes, I'm reading my spine here, the spine of the album. Pipe Dream is on Ghost Light, and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is on Masterworks Broadway. And it's so fantastic because, you know, for years, there weren't encores recordings for whatever reason. We won't get into that here. And now we have these two. And it's fascinating because one of them was done live. Pipe Dream was done live at City Center during live performances with the audience. And Gentlemen Prefer Blondes was recorded, I suppose, right after or somewhat after the show closed in a studio. And they both, to me, they're both fantastic. I think, Peter, isn't it true that you generally don't prefer live recordings?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I don't. Obviously, you know, something like Judy Garland to Carnegie Hall when she says, "I'll sing them all and we'll stay all night." You know, that's a very exciting thing. But just to have an audience applaud every time is something that I don't much like hearing. To me, it's unpleasant to the ear, frankly. And it's interesting to me that given that so many people say, oh, there shouldn't be so much dialogue on albums. Well, I don't think there should be applause on albums either, because the argument against dialogue is you get tired of it after a while. And I would think you'd get tired of the applause, too. A lot of people say, ah, but I really feel like I'm there. Good. You know, wonderful. I'm glad that pleases you. I don't get that feeling that I'm there. I know where I am when I'm listening to a recording. And, you know, it's just something that really grates on me. But I will say that here, and some people won't like the way the applause is doled out here, because it really is doled out. It's not overwhelming.
No,
and
I don't it's very much in the it's very recessed. It's not,
Yes, and this is not to imply that the show did not get enough applause during the time when it was recorded. No, it's definitely been fiddled with, to my mind, very nicely. It's the best possible live recording of a show I've heard from that standpoint, because, again, the applause doesn't annoy me nearly as much as it does in most recordings. But it really is. The sound is sensational. It really is. And I really adore hearing this score with much more vivacity than it is on that original cast album, which to me sounds like really it was painted with shellac after it was recorded. Somehow the needle just doesn't into the grooves of the LP. just never seemed to get as far into it as it possibly could. So I really much prefer this recording. There was a recording made when the Muppets were going to do Pipe Dream, when Miss Piggy was going to play Fauna. This is true, by the way. There was a demo made, and that's a very good recording too. It's not commercially released, but just with piano and just with a few songs, not many. But I think Judy Blazer was on it. She really did a terrific job. Yeah, only 10 songs. But that was my favorite Pipe Dream until this one came out now. Mm-hmm. So I think everybody will find that this is a Richard Rodgers score. I won't stand up for Hammerstein's lyrics terribly much, because they're a bit naive for the characters. But the melodies are quite fetching, and I do think it's an album worth hearing and having.
Yes, I think what we're hearing is that the applause is only what you're hearing picked up from the stage microphones.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I'm told, I don't know if this is true, but I'm told that when City Center did its renovation, it put in this system so that it could record live performances at a quality level. And that's one of the reasons why it didn't happen with Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which came earlier. So am I right? Did it? I don't know.
Well,
it came later, now that I think of it. I guess Masterworks Broadway just wanted to do it in the studio.
I think that system was also in place for Gentlemen, but they just, for whatever reason,
yeah,
they decided,
right,
they wanted to do it in the studio.
Yeah,
but
my
yeah,
mistake.
But you know, they're both terrific. On Pipe Dream, Will Chase and Laura Osnes and Leslie Uggams, the great Leslie Uggams, you know, really fantastic work. And the engineering is great. The orchestra sounds phenomenal. And on Blondes, Megan Hilty actually, to me, sounds even better than I thought in the theater. Just the character really bursts from the recording. And you know, it can be hard to. I would think it would be. It might be difficult to recreate a character in a studio under those conditions, you know, and make it really theatrical. But most people seem to do a really good job of that when doing cast albums. And
well,
and
to be fair, I mean, it must be harder for somebody like Megan Hilty and the cast of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, because they didn't do it that much. You know, I mean, by the time in the old days anyway, when original cast albums were made, usually the people who've been doing it for a month, either in previews or out of town, you know, that type of thing. So they had much more time to develop the character, you know. But Megan Hilty and everybody else's Gentlemen Prefer Blondes didn't have that much time, but you'd never know it from the album. What I adore about it is the dance music. I love what I'm doing. I mean, who would think that would be a highlight of this album? But it certainly is for me, because the dance music kicks in and it lasts a long time. I mean, I adore dance music, and this certainly is great dance music. So that to me is the greatest asset of this album, that it has so much of that in there.
Well, and especially because, yeah, the original was 1949, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, I mean, aside from everything else, they were able to fit so little on an LP. And, I mean, that was the infancy of LPs.
Sure, sure.
I mean, that was, I think, actually the first year, literally, or maybe the second year.
Well, they started in 48, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, 49, granted, the end of 49, but even so, your point is well taken.
Right, so, and so, you know, so they just couldn't fit it. And so now you have, I mean, you can fit 80 minutes on a CD, mm-hmm. I believe. Mm-hmm. So it's like almost twice as much, you know, basically when it comes down to it. And yeah, Megan Hilty's great. Rachel York, really fantastic.
I agree.
And Aaron Lazar, who I think we're going to have as a guest on our podcast coming up in a couple of weeks. Sounds just beautiful. Singing a lot of lovely songs that were cut from the film, you know. Pick up both of these, really. They're just really fantastic.
Yeah. The last recording we're going to talk about tonight is a recording that we mused, we didn't think would happen, then came out of nowhere, and it got recorded on Chickaboom. So Carrie, what they're calling the premiere cast recording.
Is it? I don't know.
You know,
a lot of us have had recordings of Carrie in our houses for a long time.
commercial.
Yes, I guess. So I guess the answer is yes and no. I mean, Michael, fess up. Do you have Carrie in your house with Betty Buckley?
I have two versions on my iPod. I have Betty Buckley, and I have Barbara Cook.
Yep, that they live in my house too. Believe me. So I mean, but yes, this is the premier official cast recording. So you know, good luck to it. It was a nice party the other night. A terrific kickoff party at 54 Below, which is a pretty room if you haven't been. And and the cast was hearing it for the first time. And
Really?
A good time was had by all. It really was. It was a very nice affair, and it's been picked up for amateur and stock rights by Rodgers and Hammerstein. Ted Chapin said, I know that it doesn't seem that Rodgers and Hammerstein and Carrie would go together, but you know, we're picking it up. And he says, you know, applications have been pouring in, and I bet they have. I believe that, because certainly this is a show that speaks to high school students in more than one way. And needless to say, the cast is supposed to be high schoolers. So it might ultimately be a very exciting high school production here and there, because you know, seeing real kids do it as opposed to kids in their 20s, whom we've always seen do Carrie in the two productions that we've seen here in New York. So that's great. You know, I'm delighted it's going to get done, because it really has a lot to say to teenage audiences. Never mind the blood, never mind the supernatural aspects. The fact remains that this is about a girl who is bullied, who is terrorized, you know, and that's tough. And also, you know, a lot of kids may not have mothers as crazy as Margaret White, and we can only hope they don't. But nevertheless, certainly kids have issues with parents who want them to do this, that, and the other thing. And so they'll relate to that part of it too. So I think it was a smart acquisition for R&H.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's going to get done a million times. And I think that lots of theater junkies, I want to say, are going to be doing this from amateur stock productions all the way through nice regional productions. I'm interested to see how people slice and dice it and what they will come up with. Mm-hmm. So that's it for this week. Do you guys have anything coming up you want to mention?
Well, I do want to mention the Ivy Awards that were given out in Minneapolis.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, they were given out. They'll be given out on tomorrow night, actually, but the winners have been announced. And I was very pleased to see Tracy Bennett win for End of the Rainbow. You know, so that doesn't surprise me at all, because she was awfully good in that show. So I thought I'd bring that up.
She wasn't. She was not.
We...
I don't know. She got the Ivy Award, Michael. I mean, you know, people
go see Forbidden Broadway, and it'll tell you all you need to know about Tracy Bennett and End of the Rainbow.
Well, you can't say that both of us don't stand by our guns, because
you cannot say that.
So that's my last remark of the night.
All right,
I have a few things. We may have mentioned there's this new revised version of Marry Me a Little that's about to open, and that's getting a lot of really good buzz, I must say, so I'm very excited about that. And there's also a new production of The Elixir of Love opening at the Met, which, aside from everything else, is interesting because Bartlett Sher is directing it. And I guess the the season is about to sort of really get going in a big way.
Yeah, there's press reps are not sleeping these couple of weeks as all the announcements come out, and lots of really great ones too. It looks like it's going to stack up to be quite the fall. So I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button there. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. That way, you won't miss anything. You could also listen to us through the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device and your BlackBerry. That way, you can listen to us on the fly. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you do listen to us on iTunes, please go to iTunes and leave us some feedback there, because positive feedback will help us raise our ratings in iTunes. And if you go to BroadwayRadio.com, there's show notes for this and all of our podcasts, and you can get all the back podcasts as well, and the links to all the various things we talked about in today's podcast. In fact, I pulled up that full version of Pippin and linked it in our show notes.
So that thank you.
There. And the WPAFilmLibrary.com is there, and Broadway or Bust, so you can go there and watch that. So we're a one-stop shop here. If There Is, I Haven't Found It Yet has a promo video that I included on there as well. So you can take a look at all those things if you are from out of town and are not going to be able to get it to see it. Plus, I have a link to the Ivy Awards. So that's about it for this week. So we will come back to you next week again. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino, and I want to thank you for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye, everybody.